Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, May 29th. My name is Magnus Tiewald and I'm your host for today's Speak Up. And joining me today is Ayu Sakamoto. Hello.
Hello.
Ayu is one of our new members of the spoken word team here at CJSF. And you're going to be hearing more from her over the coming months as she starts getting into creating content and interviews and other things to contribute to our programs here. We're going to talk a little more with Ayu in a little bit, but first we're going to run our first feature interview of the day. The city of Burnaby has initiated a project to issue an apology to its Chinese-Canadian community. Through much of the early part of the last century, as was happening both at the federal and provincial level, the municipal government was busy enacting many laws and policies and practices that were quite and directly discriminatory to the Chinese community of Burnaby. And now the city of Burnaby is launching a project to research that history and engage with the community, leading to ultimately to an apology. I had an opportunity to speak to Councillor Richard Lee and Lisa Codd, of a staff person at the City of Burnaby and the person who's leading the project for the city, about the apology last week. So here's our chat. Joining me today is Richard Lee, councillor for the City of Burnaby, and Lisa Codd, who's part of Burnaby staff. And we're here to talk about a project the city is undertaking to issue an apology to its Chinese-Canadian community over past policies and laws that the city of Burnaby enacted in the past century that were quite discriminatory. Perhaps we can start up, you can tell me what was the genesis of this project and why now?
All right. Thank you for the opportunity to answer that question. The city for quite a number of years now, starting mainly around 2017, has been actively researching Chinese-Canadian history in Burnaby and sharing that information with the public. And part of that research surfaced past discriminatory policies and practices of our local government in Burnaby. And as a result, a community group, the Burnaby Intercultural Planning Table, in cooperation with the Coalition Against Racism, contacted our municipal council and suggested that we undertake a process like this. Council was very supportive of that suggestion, and so we're proceeding.
Right. So the whole project is about more than just an apology. There's an effort to do research and compile the history of these policies and but also to engage the community in the discussion. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, I think it's important when you're apologizing to someone that you are also connecting to ensure that that apology is meaningful and that actions are taken in support of the apology. Similar apology processes at the City of Vancouver and New Westminster as well have included community engagement work to consult with the community, raise awareness of the issues, and also to identify legacy actions such as commemoration project that can support ongoing engagement with the community.
So what kind of policies, what kind of things have been discovered through this process? I've heard about some of them and they're kind of eye-opening in some cases.
Yeah, and there's still research to do. I think we're in our preliminary stage with our research, but there's a number of ways that as a local government, Burnaby discriminated against people of Asian descent. So some of those included joining advocacy efforts of other municipalities to try to exclude Asian immigration, for example. And some of those other actions targeted Chinese businesses. So bylaws that restricted trade licenses for greengrocers and piggery operators, which were a couple of the common businesses that Chinese Canadians had in the early part of the 20th century. And we also are the fourth bylaw. So this was a priority of Burnaby's early municipal council. The fourth bylaw enacted by Burnaby restricted employment of Asian Canadians by the local government or by anyone contracting services to the local government. And that bylaw remained in effect until 1953.
Yeah, I read another story about a bylaw that was proposed by a Vancouver-based chapter of the KKK and then adopted, well, maybe not a bylaw, but a policy adopted by Burnaby and I presume other municipalities in the area.
Yeah, so sometimes groups like the KKK advocated for discriminatory policies, and they would write to various levels of government and ask them to endorse their efforts. And yeah, our council did endorse those efforts. If I'm remembering them right, that was an effort to exclude Asian immigration.
It's interesting because we've heard a lot over the number of years about the policies put forth at the national and the provincial level. It's really interesting to see these similar things having happened at the municipal level. I guess in many ways, it's not really surprising, but it really is interesting to see what was going on. And I think one of the things about municipal governments that they have, in many cases, so many more points of contact with their citizens on even a daily basis that these kind of policies put in at the municipal level can be, in many ways, more impactful.
Yeah, and I'm sure that Councillor Lee could definitely speak to sort of the layers of discrimination by all levels of government that took place in the past.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. As you know, and many people know, that the federal government actually had the Chinese Exclusion Act in that level. So from early, probably 1885 to 1923, the Hecht Tax was imposed to the Chinese community at that time. And actually, my grandfather paid for the Hecht Tax in 1913 to get into Canada as a farmer. So at that time, the Hecht Tax was imposed starting from $50 and increasingly quickly increased to $100 and then went up to $500. I heard that at that time, $500, you can buy two building lots in Chinatown, Vancouver. Yeah. So that's a lot of money to pay back. So I think over the years, this kind of discriminatory policy had been redressed in the federal level in the 2007, and then provincially, we also did a recognition 2013-14 in that period, so that those discriminatory laws in the province level, we take out quite a few of those injustice law in the legislature in DC, and then redress that. We also just heard that, you know, Vancouver, of course, had redressed that, and New West did that as well. So I think this is a time between Vancouver and New West, Burnaby, we are going to do something on that front. So I'm very pleased to hear that. This is one page of a dark history in Canadian history. We would like to see what kind of laws and bylaws in the city level that have been passed or implemented. So I think this is a good way. As 100 years of the Chinese Exclusion Act, because after 1923, the city, the whole country actually implemented that federal law to ban actually immigration for the ordinary Chinese to come to Canada. So to 1923 until 1947, after the Second World War, that because of the Chinese veterans, their contribution to defending Canada's value, as well as went to the war for Canada, that the Canadian government actually saying that now you can vote, you can have Canadian citizenship, that kind of thing. So I think for 100 years, I think this is a day that we should commemorate and see that those unjust, these discriminatory laws won't see their lights again in the future.
So, I mean, what does it feel like to you personally as a member of the Chinese community to learn about these kind of policies enacted by the city you now represent on council?
Yeah, the KKK resolution passed by the council, endorsement by the council at that time. That was the first, I mean, I just heard about that a few months ago. So those are new to me. And I think some of those histories we need to learn more as a community to see what kind of actually bylaws will pass as a city. So I think it would be interesting that our next generation will learn about the history and also the community itself. We see that now we are really fortunate to live in a harmonious society. We should treasure our position, our daily life, and also the rights and freedom in this good Canadian society.
Have you heard from members of the community in response to this initiative?
It's from the newspaper, the Chinese Canadian newspaper. They also publish news about this initiative from Burnaby. They are very supportive. I believe also there are some people who would like to be sitting in the committee as well to see how they can contribute to this process. We learned that Burnaby also will be publishing a book about Chinese Canadians in the city, and the community is really positive on seeing the result of that book, the contents, etc. So I think thanks to the city staff and the council, and they look into this issue and very supportive of these initiatives.
In many ways, all these bylaws and policies and regulations enacted by the city and the other level governments must have really only been, in many ways, the tip of the iceberg, because when all the levels of government are putting in these kinds of policies and whatnot, that must really have emboldened individuals and even, you know, people working for the city to express and act on their racist attitudes. So, you know, you mentioned it, a dark period in history. You know, it spreads out and becomes bigger than just a matter of
of policy and bylaw. So what's the timeline for the completion of the project?
We will be going out to consult with the community in the fall and also in 2024, and we're expecting the formal apology in 2025. It's important to take the time to do the consultation and that engagement with the community. And some of this information is a surprise to members of the community. So I think we need to take the time to be able to get the word out about what happened and what is happening.
When it is offered, what will the apology look like? Will there be a public ceremony, or has that been determined yet?
That is something we'll work with the community on. I think every community will have its own desire of what they want that apology to look like in terms of the level of formality, the languages that it needs to be delivered in, the place where it might be delivered in. So there's still a lot that we want to work out, but we want to make sure that we're engaging with the community to make those decisions.
And will there be any lasting legacy or a public display or memorial?
So that also is something that will come out of the consultation to find out what those legacy projects might look like. Although, I mean, the city, as Councillor Lee mentioned, has taken on a number of projects to commemorate Chinese Canadian history in Burnaby, including a book that will be published later this year. And I think it's just important to remember that though we're talking about this incredible web of racism and discriminatory policies from all levels of government, including several local governments, that there's also these stories of incredible resilience of the Chinese Canadian community members. So we want to make sure we're also telling those stories of resilience and the way that community members contributed. And in Burnaby, a lot of that contribution was growing food. Chinese Canadian farmers grew, despite restrictions on land ownership, were able to farm an incredible amount of food that fed the region. Actually, yeah, and Councillor Lee's family was a farm family as well.
Yeah, actually the Leung's family, they still operate in the South Burnaby. So the Leung's family, they had a market garden in the Musqueam land, reserve land near Dunbar and Marine Drive. My grandfather actually farmed in that Musqueam reserve land for almost 30 years as a partner in a market garden, and so they leased the land from the First Nations and with a partner. And one time there are over, I think, 20 market gardeners in that area. So I heard many stories about the market gardeners. Larry Grant, senior elder in that community, told me a lot of stories, and including he was playing in the Hong Kong Garden, Market Garden, and then that's our interaction with my grandfather. So I think that's some of the stories to tell. Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining me today. I think this is a really important project, and as we've seen from what has come forth so far, there's a lot of stuff that people did not know about, and it's important to shine a light on those things, and it's really great to see Burnaby doing this. Thank you for joining me today, Lisa Codd with the City of Vancouver, and Richard Lee, Councillor, with the City of Burnaby.
All right. Thank
Lisa
you.
Codd and Richard Lee, Councillor with the City of Burnaby, both with the City of Burnaby. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, pleasure talking to you.
And the City of Burnaby will be continuing this project with a goal of completing in 2025. So there's a lot of work to happen yet. You can find out more about the Apology Project on the City of Burnaby website. And, of course, keep your eye out for public notices and advertisements about their engagement process, which will be happening over the next year or so. All right. Ayu is here in the studio with me today, and she's going to be getting started on doing some contributions to this program and the other Speak Ups in the morning. What are your interests in the things you're interested in covering, Ayu?
So I'm interested in some culture things. So I'm from Japan, so I want to introduce some Japanese culture, and also I'm interested in foreign cultures.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, we just had a little while ago, we had the Cherry Blossom Festival here in Vancouver.
Yeah.
Did you go to any of those events?
I didn't go because I just I temporarily returned to Japan at that time.
So you'll be maybe telling us about some Japanese artists and musicians and whatnot that you're aware of, and yeah.
Yes.
Who's your right now? Who's your favorite Japanese artist of any kind?
I like. She's already passed out, but I like Zard.
Yeah.
Is
she a musician or?
Musician. And yeah. She wrote lyrics mm-hmm. by herself.
Yeah.
And her song is really good.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I'm sorry we don't have that with us today, but next time you're on, maybe we'll do a little, we'll see if we can't track down a track and do a little something on it.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick look at the weather here in Vancouver the next week. It's going to be a pretty nice week. A bit of sun and cloud today, improving to sun and light cloud, and then a few days of sun. Not too excessively hot. We're going to have highs up to 18 or 19 degrees through the early part of the week, climbing a bit to 21 or 22 degrees later in the week with a bit of mix of sun and cloud. So a pretty mellow week. Good enough to get to the beach. Great to go out hiking or spend an evening in the park. That's what you can look forward to this week. Another thing you can look forward to this week is, starting on Thursday, is the Music Waste Festival. This is a festival that happens every year and has been going for, I'd have to look it up again, but a long time, at least 20 years, probably more. We're going to play a little documentary that will delve into the history, so I won't get into that. But the Music Waste Festival starts this Thursday and runs through Sunday all weekend at various locations in East Vancouver. And we'll talk a bit more specifically about what you can expect from the festival next week. But first off, here's a documentary produced by Jamie Sussford about the Music Waste story.
When we think of music festivals today, we still find ourselves married to this image of Woodstock. We have open fields, big stages, thousands of people probably suffering from questionable hygienic choices, and lots of booze and drugs. And to be honest, not much has changed. If anything, the idea of a music festival has been streamlined into a rite of passage for young adults. Coachella, into Sasquatch, into Sled Island, into Pemberton, there's just so many choices. And they're all big productions and, frankly, aren't very cheap. But sometimes, you don't need to spend hundreds of dollars or travel hours away to see great music or party hard. Of course, if you're from Vancouver, you probably already know this. Because you have Music Waste. Every June, for 4 days and $15, all you need to do is hop on your bike and bounce around from venue to venue. That's it. That's Music Waste. And for Vancouver's music community, it's kind of become this unofficial kickoff to summer. But there's a lot more to it than that. Music Waste comes from a true anti-establishment sentiment, born out of a sarcastic discontent with corporate music and their sponsors. There's a spirit to this festival that's rooted in history and has allowed for it to survive for 20-plus years, outliving many of the big-box competitors that it was created to protest against.
For me, I think Music Waste is this space that is very unique to Vancouver.
This is Eleanor Waring. She's a coordinator for Music Waste.
Because the festival doesn't take itself too seriously and because it's kind of volunteer run and most of the bands are really relaxed that are playing it as well, when stuff does go wrong or something happens with a venue or something has to shift, everybody kind of really has this can-do attitude where they're like, yep, okay, we're just gonna, that doesn't work, so we're gonna see what are our other options, like who can I call in for favors, like, and because everybody loves Music Waste, they're often very willing to help and to kind of overcome those hurdles.
And that's the big takeaway from Music Waste, the message from the community to itself. Don't take yourself too seriously. Now, when the original started in 1994, this was the idea. It was to push back against a festival that did take itself far too seriously and forced people to kind of bump elbows and pay to play. Initially, it was a one-off, but then it started to grow. After a couple years of hiatus, this festival was revisited again in the new millennium. This is Dustin Bromley. He used to be a coordinator for Music Waste.
So as I understand it, there was New Music West, which was, very, let's say, corporation-funded, and, you know, there's a lot of your Nickelback-style bands, your radio rock bands, and apparently their selection process was a little more, elite, or they were definitely going after a certain sound, very, very just, like, easy on the ears, and these bands, as it's been told, we're doing things that have been done, you know, thousands of times before. Cool. And a group of people started a one-day festival called Music Waste, which, as I mentioned, is a big, big middle finger to the sky to New Music West. And in subsequent years, it expanded to a multiple day festival.
But it really wasn't until the revival in 2004 that Music Waste became the festival that we would recognize it as today. This is Sarah Cordingley. She's one of the people that was around Music Waste at the time of its rebirth.
I was an intern at the Terminal City Weekly magazine, and some of the people there, in particular, John Cow, who was the music editor at the Terminal City at the time, and Darren Atwater, who was the editor, they sort of remembered or thought back nostalgically about Music Waste and thought they should resurrect it, and they... I believe they actually talked to Chris Wood, who was one of the original organizers. They bought it from him for $50 or something, or maybe even less, and they sort of took it over. And the first year was really successful and really fun, and to me, really sort of embodied exactly what it was meant to be, where it was sort of just chaos and everyone was just organizing it out of the good of their hearts and no one was really making any money.
While New Music West no longer existed, the ideals did. The idea that networking, self-promotion, and presentation were more important than the artistry behind the music was and still is a point of frustration within the Vancouver scene. During her time at Terminal City and then Only Magazine, Sarah and her team actively tried to disrupt superficiality through Music Waste and its promotion.
We often wrote sort of silly reviews of the bands that were, again, meant to just not take it too seriously. And who wants to read, you know, 85 band descriptions that are all just like talking about how great they are and how they're the next so-and-so, or, you know, how they're breaking boundaries and coming up with a new sound. It just seemed more fun to kind of make up funny stuff or tell, you know, funny stories that we knew about them. We were just so sick of bands trying to sell themselves to us, I guess.
Now, the festival's approach to actively pushing back against industry norms wasn't necessarily shared across the local scene. Bands trying to propel themselves beyond Vancouver work hard to cultivate image and press kits and didn't appreciate being called out for it.
Some of them were offensive, actually, I should say, in retrospect, that some of them were really too far and were just like vulgar and awful and rude. And some of them were maybe too true and were sort of actually poking fun at people. Something weird happened that was sort of a protest to Music Waste. And I think what happened was, this must have been in 2005 or 2006, and it was at the Columbia or Mike's Tavern. but the band, the Book of Lists, were boycotting, and then for some reason at the last minute, they decided to just like hijack a show and play. So we just like got a bunch of texts that